Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From the Scientology manual.
End of quote. Repeat the line.
So here's the story, folks.
Oh no, I'm not brave enough for politics.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Robbie Rosenhaus in on a Wednesday morning. Good morning. Filling in for John Justice here on Twin Cities News Talk. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. You can leave us a talk back going on the iHeartRadio app, clicking the microphone button in the bottom right-hand portion of the screen, and you can be in the mix for the talk back of the day later in the show. I wanted to get things started here with the rundown. But first, let's hear from Kamala Harris yesterday as she had some comments to say about Joe Biden.
And speaking about stakes, you just came out of a fundraiser. We know that many in your party have expressed concerns about President Biden's health. Just this morning, Congressman Doggett said that he's calling on President Biden to withdraw from the race, given that there's too much at stake to risk a Trump victory. What's your response to this?
Look, Joe Biden is our nominee. We beat Trump once, and we're going to beat him again, period.
Are you ready to lead the country if necessary?
I am proud to be Joe Biden's running mate. Thank you.
Well, while Kamala Harris had that to say yesterday, we'll have a lot more to say on the show today. Max Reimer will join me in studio. He's running for state office here, friend of the show, and digital guru and good human. He'll join me about midway through today's program. We'll listen back to a couple of best of segments. Isabel Brown, conservative online opinionator, she joined John just a couple of weeks ago to break down why the left is completely deranged. And then Kevin Roche from Healthy Skeptic, healthy-skeptic.com joined John in studio to talk about some malfeasance that's going on with our hospital systems. But I wanted to start here because the news broke yesterday about Joe Biden and who he's going to be welcoming to the White House. And he plans to hold a meeting with Democratic governors on Wednesday as the White House and his reelection campaign work to shore up support for him after last week's shaky debate performance. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the chair of the Democratic Governor Association, will be at the White House for the meeting. Some governors plan to attend in person while others will attend virtually. So this reminded me of, and good morning, producer Brett, the scene in Mighty Ducks when they rounded everybody up.
Hey, Yankee, do you want to play some real hockey?
Guys, it's an international competition. It's up against the world.
Hey, man, bring them on. We're ready.
And California Governor Gavin Newsom was expected to fly to D.C. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker was also expected to attend the meeting in person. So is this...
And their planes were in the flying V formation.
Yes. So I was going to leave the superhero comparison to you, Brett. So would that be an Avengers kind of uniting there in the Democratic governor vein there? Would you say that that would be the correct correlation in superhero terms?
Maybe more like the superheroes from The Boys gathering up. Okay. I think that might be more apt.
Okay, potentially. Well, the meeting comes as the White House and Biden campaign work to keep Democratic governors and other elected Democrats in the fold. After his rocky debate, Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas became the first Democratic lawmaker to call on Mr. Biden to drop out of the presidential race on Tuesday, a suggestion the campaign quickly dismissed. The meeting with governors is notable because up until this point, it's mostly been Mr. Biden's top aides and advisors who have been reaching out to elected Democrats to reassure them after his debate performance. Members of the Democratic Governors Association held a call Monday to discuss the ongoing response to last week's debate and widespread concern among the state chief executives that Mr. Biden has done little outreach to governors, specifically over the course of the campaign year, according to two people familiar with arrangements for the call. The Biden campaign had been trying to arrange time for Vice President Harris to speak with governors, but the governors decided Monday they wanted to hear directly from the president. That's why I played that Kamala Harris clip there. We'll have some clips later in the show from KJP and how she tried to defend Biden's debate performance and basically saying that this was a one-off. Listen, folks, this is the Biden, Harris, and the Democratic governors are the Bermuda Triangle of stupid. When you have all these people going in, and I saw J.B. Pritzker last night on CNN, and I believe he was with Caitlin Collins on her nightly news program. And he sat there for 12 minutes, and credit to him, he answered every single question. Now, he dodged and dipped like he was an extra in the movie Dodgeball, but he deflected, but he answered the questions to why they were going to D.C. And they wanted to hear from the president directly, and I that has to be a blinking red light in the face of the entire DFL that they're all descending on DC basically to get a status report that they don't trust that the phone call is enough. And I just think that this is another set. We talked with AK, and John had talked on Friday with multiple guests, including Tom Emmer, as to what the next step in this whole process was going to be. Well, you see it now, folks, as they descend on D.C. like Dorothy, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion all descended on Oz.
Oh, we're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. And here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Robbie Rosenhaus filling in for John Justice here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. We have an action-packed show today before everybody's off for July 4th. We hope you're off for July 4th and get to celebrate our nation's birthday. Coming up next, John did an interview a couple of weeks ago with conservative online opinionator Isabel Brown. We'll take a listen to that next. Max Reimer joining me at the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour, about halfway through the program. We have a rundown coming up. Brett and Max will play each other in a quiz. And then Jason Lewis, former congressman from the state of Minnesota, will join me in the 8 a.m. hour also. It's all coming up this morning, 6 to 9 a.m. right here on Twin Cities News Talk.
And FM 103.5.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Robbie Rosenhaus filling in for John Justice this week. John's on vacation out in California. We'll both be back on Monday with a lot to discuss. We've seen things kind of develop over the last couple of days here with Joe Biden. I'm sure over the July 4th holiday, much more will be coming out of our nation's capital. Producer Brett alongside Max Reimer will join me in just about 1 hour's time. Right now, let's take a listen back to Gen Z conservative commentator Isabel Brown. She joined John just a couple of weeks ago, and they had a very fun conversation. Let's take a listen back right now, right here on Twin Cities News Talk.
John Justice on Twin Cities News Talk. And if your social media algorithms are functioning properly, you've probably seen my next guest on your feed covering politics or and pop culture like this.
Ms. Charmaine Obaid Chinoy, I think is how I'm saying it correctly. She's a Pakistani feminist activist, I guess, that they have now appointed to be the new director for the next installment of Star Wars movies. She was speaking at some women's empowerment conference.
I like to make men uncomfortable. I enjoy making men uncomfortable.
That is the feeling that the new director of Star Wars wants you to walk away from the movie theater with. If you continue going down that path while making this film, your film's gonna suck.
Author of The End of the Alphabet, How Gen Z Can Save America. Gen Z social media influencer Isabel Brown joins me this morning. I figure with May the 4th, Isabel, that clip was appropriate. Good morning.
Absolutely, it was. Good morning, and thank you so much for having me, and happy early May the 4th.
Listen, I'll be up front. I'm a fan. I've been following your content online. Really appreciate what you're doing and the style at which you present your opinions and covering the political stories of the day and pop culture as well. I want to back up a bit. I know this isn't your first book, The End of the Alphabet. Your first book, certainly appropriate to what we've seen happening on the college campuses around the country. But can you speak a bit about how you started down this path of becoming this online Gen Z conservative commentator?
The truth is, I never expected in a million years this would be my career, working in public speaking and content creation or writing books. My dream actually was to become a surgeon, and I pursued both of my degrees in biomedical sciences, first at Colorado State University in my home state of Colorado, and then in graduate school at Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and sadly discovered very, very quickly that the reason I loved science, the pursuit of objective truth, really wasn't a hallmark aspect of the curriculum that I was paying for. Instead, I was spending a lot more time arguing with my professors about their political opinion, being told that it was scientifically impossible for God to have created the universe, or that abortion did not end a genetically unique human life, or maybe even that your chromosomes have nothing to do with your gender identity. I decided to get involved on my college campus and be a part of the solution to all of the insanity that I was seeing, and started a political club for other students my age to bring speakers like Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens, Dennis Prager, and more, and really started a revolution from the inside out on our college campus to reclaim critical thinking, challenging your perspectives, and bringing conservative, timeless values to the campus environment. Fast forward, and long story short, I fell in love with activism and now get to continue telling people the truth every single day, not just on my college campus, but on campuses across the country and in the digital space, which truly is where Gen Z spends most of our time.
You know, it's interesting to me with your content, because you always seem to have a smile on your face regardless of the issue that you're talking about. As a talk show host of 28 years, that is something that I have not been able to accomplish. But I find that it's been effective, at least for me, in your ability to sort of bring these issues to the forefront. Have you found that aspect of the way that you present the content and the stories of the day has been effective? Because it seems different than a lot of other individuals that are sort of occupying their space while they're doing a good job as well. Yours seem to be breaking through, just from my perspective.
You know, I'm nothing if not an eternal, endless optimist. And often I get criticized for my optimism. People will say that it's naive or silly or too youthful to have hope for the future. But I've just noticed such a seismic shift within this new generation, my generation and Gen Z, coming into adulthood and becoming the next big conversation in the American political space and culture as well. You can take the route of doom and gloom, which I think is what we took largely with millennials in terms of saving Western civilization, or you can fight for something that you're proud to call home again and embrace this optimism that I think we desperately need in the 2020s when everything constantly feels like it's falling apart. I have found that the smile on your face and remembering to laugh mentality is much more effective in reaching those of us under 30 years old today. And just this morning, I was watching a video from Ole Miss's campus yesterday where the new Palestine encampment tried to pop up in the middle of campus on Ole Miss's quad there with about a dozen people, and surrounding those dozen people were 1,000 other students laughing, smiling, and joyfully singing the national anthem. So I think that joyful aspect really is a hallmark trait of who we are as a generation, and I'm excited to see it become more prominent moving forward.
Talking with Isabel Brown, author of The End of the Alphabet, How Gen Z Can Save America, at the Isabel B on X, and I'll tell you where you can find her as well on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. It's interesting you bring that up, because I thought that the GoFundMe that was put up for the frat bros, for lack of a better word, that went and defended the American flag, you know, it, you know, at a time when in recent history would look back at individuals, guys like that, and they'd be labeled with a toxic masculinity, here you have this moment in time during these ridiculous protests taking place, and yet they're being looked at as heroes in defending the flag, and I thought that was an interesting moment in the middle of all this chaos.
Absolutely correct, and I just checked. As of right now, they've raised more than $516,000 for these young men, specifically to throw them a party, which is going to be the party to end all parties, clearly. But I think it's so much more than the dollar amount here. This speaks volumes about the temperature of our country in honoring goodness, truth, and beauty in society again. The media is giving these encampments and these insane protests that largely are being organized by professional agitators, paid protesters, and even wives of known terrorists, believe it or not, as we are now finding out on social media, not college students. And yet they're using these campuses as a staging ground to try to point the finger at young people being so overwhelmingly pro-Hamas or pro-terrorism. But that photo of these young men holding up the flag, and now the unbelievable amount of support that they're receiving from around the country, really speaks volumes to me about where real Americans really lie and where the vast majority of us are.
Your first book, Frontlines, Finding My Voice on an American College Campus, I know that goes back to February of 2021. I have to imagine, I mean, not being so far removed from college, it's got to be an interesting for you to watch what's been taking place over the course of the past few weeks with these protests that we were just discussing. You know, they seem to be made up of a core group of individuals that are funded by various organizations, but then you have the sort of those that are latching on to it, and we've seen videos of individuals that are protesting that I have no idea what they're protesting about. I'd be interested to hear a little bit more of your perspective of what we've seen happen the past few weeks.
It has been absolutely fascinating, and I've been covering it at length on my daily live stream. But, you know, it's interesting. When I was in college, and the reason I wrote my first book is we were experiencing the beginning of the rise of Antifa and organized protests by the left. When I had Charlie Kirk invited to come speak at Colorado State University, hardly a very controversial campus in the last several decades, for example, there was so much backlash in our community from Antifa that I received personally countless death threats, people threatening to harm me. My address was doxed online. And there were so many protests the day of the event, ironically, about free speech, that they actually had to deploy the Colorado National Guard to my college campus just to keep students safe on campus. And as I moved through the rest of my college experience and watched more Gen Zers come into the fold rather than the millennials older than myself who had been graduating, things seemed to get much more temperate in the campus environment, and there was a deeper hunger for real ideological exchange and true education, which is what college is supposed to be all about, instead of all of the indoctrination we had previously been receiving. Now, what I'm seeing with these encampments on college campuses is far more organized, well-funded, well-scripted, with specific media talking points, etc., than anything that existed when I was on my college campus. I mean, you're watching matching tents pop up across the country. They have matching signs, matching slogans that are approved for quote-unquote media interviews. It is highly more organized, and most of the videos that I'm seeing go viral of these insane protesters are of people who clearly are not 18 to 21 years old. Of course, there are the handful of those students who are latching on to this, but most students I'm seeing are making fun of these protests. They're memeing them on the internet. They're complaining about how their graduation is being canceled because of this insanity. And they're holding up the American flag, proudly singing our national anthem.
At the Isabel Brown YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, at the Isabel B on X. Let's get to your book. the end of the alphabet, how Gen Z can save America. You know, I hear from people all the time. They want to know, you know, what is the future going to be? It's the biggest question. Everybody seems so divided. You know, we have generations that are coming up. We see what's happening on college campuses. I look at my own sons. I have a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old. Talk about your book, your decision to write the book, and what you're hoping people will get out of it.
I decided to write the end of the alphabet largely stemming from a place of frustration over the last several years, being asked to be a token voice for Gen Z and constantly being told by those older than myself in media interviews or at political events and speeches that Gen Z was destroying America, that this group of 70 million people born between 1997 and 2012 are directly responsible for the rise of gender theory in this country, for throwing mashed potatoes at paintings in museums to stop climate change and all of the insanity that we're seeing. And I knew from my experience on my college campus that that wasn't really entirely true. It certainly isn't what I'm observing in the digital activism space, interacting with truly tens of millions of Gen Zers every single day across social media platforms. So I decided to get out and tell people the actual truth of Gen Z, which is very profound. On a cultural and lifestyle choices perspective, Gen Z is actually proving ourselves to be the most conservative generation in America since World War II. 93% of us still want to get married in a time that we have the lowest marriage rate in American history. 62% of us have already started our own businesses, and we're resurrecting that entrepreneurial American dream again. We're realizing we don't need to spend $250,000 to get a degree in, I don't know, what would be popular today, underwater lesbian Islamic jihad basket weaving, because that's not going to be successful. And we're choosing trade school at record numbers. Even on smaller things, I'm just truly astounded the choices that our generation is making. We're quitting our hormonal birth control. We're deleting our dating apps. We're eating real food and real meat again in a time that we've been told to eat plant-based chemicals or stuff grown in a laboratory. And all of this is tracking as the same pattern of behavior that every young group of people has embraced throughout history. We want to rebel against the people who came before us. And it just so happens that to be radically countercultural and a punk rock rebel today is to embrace conservatism in a world governed by the left.
You going to celebrate May 4th?
Oh, of course I am. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we're heading to go see The Phantom Menace in theaters. So this would be the first time my youngest has actually the only second Star Wars movie that he's seen on the big screen. So listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Like I said, I'm a fan. I can scratch you off my bucket list of interviews that I've been wanting to do on the show. I encourage everybody to go and pick up Isabel Brown's book, The End of the Alphabet, How Gen Z Can Save America. Again, at the Isabel B on X and at the Isabel Brown YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Thank you so much for the time this morning, and keep doing what you're doing. I know that for me, it's encouraging when I see your posts, Isabel, in the wake of what I do on a daily basis, because I know there are individuals like yourself and others that are coming up behind us older dudes and are bringing the conservative message with them. So thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Isabel Brown, Gen Z conservative commentator with John Justice just a couple of weeks ago. Robbie Rosendahl's filling in for John this week. John's on vacation. We'll both be back in our usual spots on Monday. We hope everybody has a great July 4th. Coming up next, Kevin Roche from healthy-skeptic.com joined John just a couple of weeks ago to talk about some of the problems that are going on in our hospital system. Max Reimer will join me just about 1 hour from now to go through the rest of the show. Jason Lewis coming up in the 8 a.m. hour. We'll play a quiz later on. The rundown coming up at the top of the hour. Ton of stuff to get to right here on Twin Cities News Talk. Back here on Twin Cities News Talk, filling in for John Justice this morning. Got a ton to get to, but first up, healthy-skeptic.com's Kevin Roche joined John just a couple of weeks ago. Let's take a listen back to that right now.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. John Justice, producer Robbie. Very pleased to welcome back to the studio, healthy-skeptic.com, the healthy skeptic Kevin Roche. Good morning, Kevin. Good to see you again.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
It's been a while, probably too long, so thank you so much for coming in. I was drawn in by the article. It was on Alpha News. I know it's also on your website, the healthy-skeptic. Employers and consumers are getting ripped off by hospitals. It caught my attention. Anecdotal story kind of relates to this. But when I went through my last medical deal a couple of years back, there was a mistake that my surgeon's team made. They started sending me all of the texts of all the equipment purchases that were necessary for my procedure. So from out of nowhere, I started getting inundated just with text after text after text. And it was really enlightening from the standpoint of the amounts attached to these particular items. I know nothing about the cost of medical equipment, but I'm just looking at it and I'm beginning to see the snapshot of why these types of surgeries are so expensive. Going through your piece here, I thought it was really enlightening, this relationship between the services, the hospitals, healthcare spending, privately paid services, and how, as you mentioned in the headline, you know, employers and consumers like myself are getting ripped off by hospitals. So kind of setting the stage, I'll hand it over to you. How are consumers and employers getting ripped off by the hospitals?
Yeah, and ripped off may be a little strong.
I don't think so.
But I think, you know, there's kind of big picture ways to look at things and more micro ways. From a big picture, I'm not sure people realize how much over the last 2 to 3 decades the U.S. healthcare system has consolidated. So what we thought of as a hospital rarely exists anymore. Now it's a huge health system that owns or employs doctors, owns nursing homes, rehab facilities, labs, every kind of provider. And these systems have also consolidated horizontally. You know, where in the Twin Cities, there might at one time have been 10 independent hospitals. Now we have 2 or 3 mm-hmm. large systems, and the level of competition has gone down. And as these hospitals have gained market power, they've increased prices. And one of the things that people look at is Medicare sets the prices that it pays hospitals based on an evaluation of their costs. They look at the labor costs, they look at the costs of building a facility, of having equipment, and they set reimbursement that's designed to cover that cost. So at least theoretically, what hospitals are getting paid by Medicare covers the cost of providing a particular service. And then when you compare that to what private health plans pay or what an individual would pay, as I said in the article, what the research consistently shows is these hospitals are sometimes charging twice as much, more than twice as much for the exact same service. And that flows through to the average consumer who's covered by employer health insurance, both in the form of higher premiums, but also in the form of higher cost sharing. If you have a deductible mm-hmm. or you have coinsurance, you're going to pay more for that as well. And that is due solely to what I think is you know, a failure of the regulators to stop this level of consolidation from happening. It's kind of ironic now, the Biden administration is kind of on a big kick to stop and even potentially undo some of the consolidation that has occurred in healthcare. But it's obviously too late once you've allowed this to happen. And then on the other side, on the health plan side, we've similarly seen a massive consolidation. And my friends down the road here, United Health Group, are the kind of preeminent example of that. Mm-hmm. So in most markets, and again, the Twin Cities is also an example of this, you have very few health plan choices. And so what we've come to have now is kind of a system where one oligopoly, that big health systems, meets another oligopoly, the big health plans, and they've chosen the path of least resistance, which is instead of fighting, the health plans really fighting to lower prices, the health plans kind of go, fine, I'll pay them whatever, because I will just turn around and raise the premiums for employers and for individuals. So in some ways, the system's evolved into something where there's nobody who's really looking out for how do I keep costs lower for the people who ultimately pay it, which is all of us as consumers.
Talking with Kevin Roche, Healthy Skeptic, thehealthy-skeptic.com. You know, I've seen throughout the course of my life and dealing with my own health issues, how this dynamic of consolidation has really changed, even before we get to the cost aspect of it. You're right. The choices have become so limited where before, I could have a cardiologist with one particular group, but then I could have a surgeon that I wanted to choose with a different particular group and then choose the facility of where I wanted to have it, have it at the hospital facility. And now with all the consolidation, it's become more difficult and cumbersome and burdensome to go that route where you're kind of pushed into a situation as, no, you want your team all under the same roof, all with the same organization. And in one way, you would go, okay, well, that makes sense. But at the other way, you kind of go, well, they should be able to communicate with each other. And I should have some choice here of the different individuals as I go through this. And you could potentially do that, but it makes dealing with those health issues even more difficult than they already are dealing with. And it's gotten to the point in what you're describing here of it's almost grown so big you can't really do anything of it. I mean, one of the questions that I had for you was, in order for this to change, you'd have to almost completely, upend the entire infrastructure in order to get this to change. That's what it would seem like. I mean, I don't know how you would undo this.
Yeah, you would literally have to force divestitures, which will be disruptive and will cause issues, but if you want a health system that's more competitive, not just in terms of price, but in terms of quality and patient satisfaction, that's what you would need to do. For a long time, the industry, both on the health plan side and on the provider side, has attempted to justify all of this consolidation by saying it would lower costs, which it clearly has not done, but also that it would improve quality, that in fact having all of these different providers together would improve communication and would improve kind of handling the patient across an entire episode of care. But that's also not occurred. The research very clearly shows that all of this consolidation not only hasn't improved quality, it's probably lessened it. And part of the reason for that is, I think we've all experienced this, when you're part of a big organization, frankly, your satisfaction with your work, your perception about your control over your work changes. And we see that. Hospitals buy physician practices. The physicians become more dissatisfied with their jobs. And that's not good for patient care. So from my perspective, none of the benefits that were supposed to occur because of all this consolidation have occurred. In fact, at best, quality's the same. And for sure, we're all paying a whole lot more because of it.
We had some comments that have rolled in, some questions for our guests this morning, Kevin Roche at The Healthy Skeptic. And if you have any questions you'd like to ask, you can leave a talk back. If you're listening on the iHeartRadio app, you can also email justice@iHeartMedia.com.
Hi, guys. I would like to ask the question of The Healthy Skeptic. How likely are we to maybe in the next 5 to 10 years going back to HMOs, which is not any better than what we have now? I'm just curious his thoughts on that.
Well, most people are now in a health plan, and because I've been around way too long, because kind of when HMOs, health maintenance organizations, which were sort of promoted heavily by the federal government, when they started becoming pretty common, there was a perception, because of the limited provider networks, that they were in some ways restricting people's choices and benefits. So the organizations, and United Health Group was one of the leaders in this, who own those health plans, started broadening them out into preferred provider organizations and other types of health plans. But they're still regulated largely as health maintenance organizations. So most people are still in health plans that technically are health maintenance organizations. It's just the structure of those organizations in terms of the size of the provider network and the degree of choice among providers has generally changed. And what a really interesting change that's happened over the last 20 years and really the last 5 to 10 years is the extent to which Medicare has become a health plan kind of payer. Over half the people who are covered by Medicare are now in Medicare Advantage plans, which are just like, you know, a private health plan that you would have if you were an employee at a company. So the technical regulatory nature of these plans hasn't changed. The design and the options has changed and has become, I think, generally more consumer friendly in terms of provider choice.
I know in your piece, you cite this new report from the RAND Corporation looking at the differences in what hospitals are paid by Medicare and what they charge private health plans. Hospitals have been forced, you write, to disclose contracted rates for several years, so the data is available now. The authors found that in every state, what private health plans pay hospitals is far above what Medicare pays them for the same services, even after the patient factor adjustment, and in many situations is two or three times more than what Medicare pays. In fact, and on average, a private health plan paid 250% of the Medicare reimbursement for the same service. You know, and that goes back to my question from before. I mean, in order for you to change that, you know, that money is going somewhere. I mean, you'd have to uproot it where those dollars are going, because those entities are used to getting that income stream coming in. And I don't know how you would be able to undo that unless you just turned everything upside down and started new.
Yeah. Well, and that's, and I've written other pieces about kind of hospital finances more generally. What's one of the consequences of the consolidation and the increased market power, and this is typical in any industry, not just healthcare, is that when that happens, the businesses become less cost conscious. And we've certainly seen that. I think people are probably completely unaware. The executives in these large not-for-profit health systems are paid millions and millions and millions of dollars. They build huge staffs who are also extremely well paid. You walk into some of these facilities, you see marble, you see really fancy wood. So money's being spent on that kind of stuff. We see the advertising and the marketing. You know, if you went into a hospital system and you said, you know, I'm going to design my facility and run my business in a way that I try to do what I should do as a not-for-profit entity and make the cost of my service as low as it can be without compromising quality, you would save an immense amount of money. So all of the money that's generated by these excess prices goes into stuff like compensation, having way too many administrative staff, while at the same time there are shortages of clinical staff, having these extremely fancy buildings and, you know, equipment that's not needed. So, you know, there's a big issue about, you know, how do you make these entities more efficient? And I personally think the best way to do that is let the market do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that assumes that you have competition. So,
we're back to what we started talking about, right?
So if you did not allow multi-hospital systems in the Twin Cities, I think all of a sudden you'd see hospitals figuring out how to get a lot more efficient in terms of their cost structure.
Let's get back to another question for Kevin Roche, who joins me in studio, the Healthy Skeptic.
Hey, John. Dan from Elko. I'd like to have you ask your guests how much of the increase of costs is a result of people who don't pay their bills and the hospital just ends up having to absorb the cost of it. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, you have any thoughts or info on that?
Yeah, so most health systems are not-for-profit. They are also tax-exempt. And as part of their tax-exempt status, they're required to pay to provide a certain level of charity care, you know, to take on people who don't have money. So there is some element of that, and Medicare takes that into account in how they pay hospitals. The reality is there are not that many people anymore who don't have some form of coverage. And the ones who don't, unfortunately, it's often homeless people and others who, you know, have difficulty taking care of themselves adequately in most aspects of their life. Hospital bad debt levels have not really risen significantly. The most notable thing that's happened, which a lot of people will know, is if you may have a deductible in your health plan under which you're responsible for the first $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 of a bill, if you go into a hospital and you're suddenly presented with a bill for $2,000, you do see stories, and I think there is a fair amount of debt, but in total, that doesn't really add up to that much, and it's not that much of a burden on the hospitals. So it's a bit of an issue, but it doesn't really account for, doesn't really have anything to do with how hospitals price.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before of the sort of how the top end of the money, where the money is going at the top end. Let's get back to another question from the iHeartRadio app for Kevin Roche.
Question for Kevin. Is this consolidation of the big healthcare systems and squeezing out of independence and of our choices, which was all part of the ACA, do you see that as the next step to government-run healthcare, that let's consolidate all these systems, and then there's a few bigs, and we just take it over?
You know, it's interesting, too, because that narrative and that drive has kind of been pushed off to the side. I know a lot of that's in the wake of Obamacare, but your thoughts on where sort of the next step of all this is potentially going?
You know, there is and has been for a long time a significant group that believes in a not just a single payer system, which would basically put everyone into a Medicare-like program, but also believes in a government-run health system, which is what England has, as well as government-sponsored insurance. My sense of that has always been that most Americans are still very leery about having the government control things, and most people have enough experience with various aspects of government to question the level of quality and the service that they might get out of a system like that. But there are definitely people who want to do that. There are definitely people who will use the fact that there is a big cost issue as a justification for going to that kind of a single payer system or government run healthcare system. I don't think it'll happen.
Let's get to, as typically happens, Kevin, when we have you on, we ran out of all the other stuff we're going to talk about. So we'll certainly invite you back in studio again soon. But let's get to one more question from the iHeartRadio app for you this morning.
Good morning, John, Robbie, and the Healthy Skeptic. Question, could you define what a hospital system is? Are we talking Park Nicollet and Ridgeview, for example? Do those fit in the hospital system? You've also mentioned health system. Are those the same? Does that differ? Just looking for some basic understanding and definitions. Thanks. Have a great day, guys.
So the healthcare system in the United States has become more complex, and now we see, and Twin Cities is an example of this, you see hybrid kind of organizations. So Park Nicollet, which I used to work at one point, originally was a freestanding physician practice. Park Nicollet was eventually acquired by the Health Partners system, which is a big health plan in the Twin Cities and also owns hospitals, owns clinics. So that's an example of kind of a hybrid organization that's both a payer and a provider. We see that model increasingly. It was originally the model for the, quote, group health plans and for Kaiser, where they both sold the insurance but also kind of owned the provider systems. It's pretty rare to find a standalone hospital anymore, so it's probably technically more correct to refer to them as health systems. And typically, when I use that term, I mean an organization that owns hospitals but also owns large numbers of physician practices, has a lab, has imaging centers, probably has skilled nursing facilities, rehab facilities, so across the kind of spectrum. And I think that's a pretty common model today. We now have seen in the private health plan world a beginning of significant melding of the provider and payer worlds. People probably don't know, United Health Group is the largest single employer of physicians in the country. They own a ton of physician practices, including specialty practices. They contract to manage another large number of physicians. So we're seeing these worlds kind of merge. And as in most things, you get to a level of economic power that it is not necessarily good for the consumer.
The website is healthy-skeptic.com. Kevin Roche, as always, thank you so much for the time. We'll definitely have you back in again soon. Clearly, we have a lot to discuss based off of the questions as well. So thank you so much for the time this morning. Always great speaking with you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So here's the story, folks.
All right, folks. We just listened back to Gen Z conservative commentator Isabel Brown, healthy-skeptic.com's Kevin Roche. Both appeared with John Justice over the last couple of weeks. It's time to get to the rundown. After the break, we'll have Max Reimer coming up as well, a quiz with producer Brett against Max, and Jason Lewis coming up, all right here on Twin Cities News Talk.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.